This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio
Free
Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
The canoe has played an integral role in the lives of people in this part of the world for thousands of years. First Nations used them to get to potlatches, to trade with their neighbors, and to catch whales and seals. The designs ranged from short, one-person craft to canoes more than 60 feet long that could carry dozens of people. Canoe Crossings is a new book by Sanford Osler. Sanford Osler says he's been interested in canoes for as long as he can remember. Canoe Crossings takes us from the very earliest days of the canoe to its current place in the culture of British Columbia. And Sanford Osler joins me this morning in the studio. Good morning, Sanford.
Good morning, Jane.
Now, the canoes that many of us are familiar with are based on a design not used historically here in BC. What kind of craft is our modern-day canoe based on?
Well, the one most people think of when they think of a canoe in Canada is based on the birch bark canoe that's more prevalent in eastern Canada. Birch bark is quite a common tree throughout most of Canada, but once you cross the Rockies, we don't have the quality of birch for the traditional birch bark canoe. But the Tom Thompson style canoe that people think of was based on the birch bark canoe from eastern areas.
Here, the traditional craft was the dugout canoe. What was it made from?
Dugout canoes on the coast were typically made from western red cedar, which is a fabulous tree for this purpose. In the interior of BC, they were often made from cottonwood trees.
Oh, cottonwood trees will make a canoe?
Indeed, indeed.
And did every different First Nation have a different kind of dugout canoe?
They usually had certain stylistic differences, partly a function of the environment they were paddling in and partly to reflect their cultural values.
Now, I understand that the Haida Nation had a very special place in the canoe-making world.
Well, of course, being island people, they had to have excellent craft because they would go to the mainland and up and down the coast. So having first-class canoes was essential for them. And fortunately, they had fabulous trees. They had these huge western red cedars. So the combination of needing to be excellent on the water and having fabulous resources led them to specialize in canoe making to the point where they were exporters of canoes to other First Nations.
I read that in your book and I was so surprised. So they would actually make canoes and then trade them with other nations?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Took advantage of their skills and resources.
Now, you write that the Haida canoes that we were just talking about have some advanced design features for ocean travel. Tell me about them.
Well, they do. First of all, they're incredibly buoyant to the point where you'd have to put ballast in if you weren't fully loaded. Otherwise, it would ride too high and be difficult to steer. Also, they had high rises at both the front and back of the canoe, which allowed the craft to work on the open ocean and be somewhat dampened by the big waves or swells.
So the big pieces, I mean, I have in my mind the image of a Haida canoe. I always thought that was decorative, the big pieces back and front, but they actually had a function?
Oh, definitely. They would help the canoe ride more smoothly going into big waves, for instance. They would take some of the wave rather than have it, you know, break over the front. And then they also had a cutwater, a very sharp bow, and that was also to keep it going in a straight line rather than twisting as it was going down a wave and that sort of thing. So through trial and error, they evolved the design, the shape, the length to accommodate their needs.
And they have some pretty intense seas around there.
Well, they do, particularly the stretch between Haida Gwaii and the mainland. It's quite a shallow strait. And it can really blow.
They must have been phenomenal paddlers, too.
Oh, tremendous skill. The first Europeans that saw them, because they would typically come out to meet the sailing craft, were just in awe of the skills. I mean, they were seamen themselves, but they were in awe of the ability of the First Nations with canoes.
Now, I don't know if you saw the film In the Land of the Headhunters by Edward Curtis that recently showed. Did you see that film?
Yes.
Because that was one thing that really struck me as a beginning canoeist, just the way that they handled the boats in that film.
Well, yes. I mean, this was a skill that was developed at an early age. And, I mean, they had to be good at it, and they were. I mean, it was used for... There were many different types of canoes, and there were a variety of functions. So they were, you know, that was second nature to them.
Now, traditional canoe building skills all but disappeared on the coast in the 19th century. Why was that?
Well, in the 1900s, 20th century, they really stopped making them for several reasons. First of all, the numbers of First Nations people often just collapsed enormously, sometimes to 10% of their previous levels from smallpox and other diseases. So they didn't always have the critical mass for finding, cutting, carving, and paddling these big canoes. Secondly, the laws in the late 1800s banned gatherings like potlatches. So they didn't have the need for these big canoes to travel to events up and down the coast. And sometimes the purpose of the canoe was to be a gift. So again, that discouraged it. And then new technology, there were other ways of making canoes came along and other ways of powering them. So all those things combined to, essentially in the last 100 years, they stopped making the big canoes.
Bill Reid, who many people will be familiar with his artwork, the famous Haida artist, helped to bring traditional Haida canoes back to coastal waters. Tell me the story about Bill Reid and the canoe Lutas.
Well, that's a very important story in the rebirth of the canoes in BC. Bill Reid, of course, was had a Haida mother and was working in jewelry and small materials as an artist. And then decided he wanted to get into bigger materials. He did totem poles. And then what he, I think, considered was his greatest work was a 50-foot canoe called Lutas, which means wave eater, that was commissioned for Expo 86. So when he knew he had to do this work, he researched it carefully. He built a small prototype, then a medium-sized prototype, and finally the 50-foot version, because nobody had the skills to do it anymore. So he had to research it from museum pieces and do this trial and error, you know, scaling it up in size. And Lutas was a Haida-designed canoe, the Haida shape, and was a big hit at Expo 86. But its most important journey was the next year when it paddled up to Haida Gwaii, stopping at all the coastal villages en route and being a real eye-opener for many of the native people who hadn't seen a dugout canoe. And even the elders, it was often what they'd heard from their parents. And it triggered an interest in these communities rebuilding the canoes that they used to have. And in fact, that's what's happened. And now each year, these canoes from up and down the coast get together annually at a different place.
I wanted to ask you about that, but I just wanted to go back to the story of Bill Reid, because there was a very moving part in your book where they said that part of the research was they went into the forests in Haida Gwaii, mm-hmm. and they found canoes that were half built and had been abandoned because of the smallpox epidemic.
Exactly. And in fact, I was in Haida Gwaii this summer and we found one of those canoes. Sometimes it was because of smallpox epidemics or something like that. But other times when they started to carve it, they would find it would be rotten or something. It would not be suitable to complete. So sometimes we don't know why they stopped, but there were a number of found abandoned in the woods.
And the last, the last part of the story with Bill Reid was that his remains were actually taken back to Haida Gwaii on that canoe.
Exactly. Back to his birthplace on his mother's side.
Now, you mentioned the canoe journeys that take place now on the coastal waters. And there's an annual event called Tribal Journeys. How did that get started?
Well, that came out directly from the Bill Reid Lutas, because when he went up the coast and he inspired people to build their own canoes, that's what happened. And then they started to gather, first every 4 years and now annually at different places. This last summer, for instance, they were at Bella Bella. So they converged on Bella Bella from points north and south, and had 4 or 5 days of celebrations, and they will go to a different place each year.
That must just be tremendously important for people.
Well, it is. I witnessed them when they came into Cowichan Bay several years ago, and there were over 100 canoes coming from all points of the compass there, because it was north, south, east, and west. And each canoe was in a group geographically, and they would come maybe 20 or 30 canoes at a time and seek permission to land in peace, and then they would be welcomed by the local chief, and then they would be feasted, and there would be these enormous events that would go on for days where they celebrated the getting together, and gifts would happen, and they would exchange. One of the chiefs actually calls villages up and down the coast the Canoe Nation. In other words, that is the common denominator for these coastal First Nations villages is the canoe, and they call themselves the Canoe Nation.
So those journeys are reviving the skills of building the canoe, the knowledge of the protocols.
Very much so. It's not just the people in the canoe that are affected by these journeys. It's the people that are hosting the canoes as well. I mean, it triggered a whole revival, particularly with the younger people who had to learn the skills and the protocols. So it was absolutely critical in the resurgence of not only canoeing, but of culture.
Just going back to Bill Reid for a moment, I know that you wrote in your book that he saw the canoe as actually being the centerpiece of Haida art.
Oh, yes. I mean, he, you know, through his research, he really felt he had to do a canoe because it was at the heart and soul of the culture.
There's another canoe journey that was started by artist Roy Henry Vickers and Ed Hill, who's an artist and an RCMP staff sergeant, called Vision Quest. Tell me about that.
Yes, this is another interesting one. In 1997, a group of canoes, three canoes, set off from the Hazelton area and paddled down to Victoria, 1,000 miles, for the official purpose of raising money to fund a recovery house for people with substance abuse issues in British Columbia, because one did not exist at that point in time. And it was successful in raising money, and in fact now Vision Quest has a number of recovery houses in BC. But the unofficial purpose, and the reason the RCMP got so interested, is they wanted to improve relations with the First Nations, because up and down the coast, the local name for policeman was the man that takes you away, because they had the job of enforcing the residential school rules, the no potlatch rules, etc., right? So people would hide when the policeman would come. And of course, they want to be your friend and who you go to in trouble. So they decided to come back to the communities in a more traditional way. So Roy Henry Vickers, it was his idea actually, and he teamed up with police officers. They visited all these communities in their three canoes, and they apologized for the role they'd had to play in the past, and they started and they basically sought to reopen the relationship, and it was a very moving experience for those involved, and I think it did help turn the page a bit in that relationship.
You paddled on, I think you said, a couple of different trips with that Vision Quest. Tell me about that.
Well, the one I was on was the one in 2010 that went from Port Moody all around the outside of Vancouver to White Rock. And they do different routes each year in order to expose different people to the whole concept. Because what they do now, the modern version, it's organized either by police officers or a First Nations group. And the real group that they're aiming at now are teens at risk, First Nations teens at risks, to give them a different experience. So when I was on it, we would head off fairly early in the morning and stop for lunch and then be welcomed at the longhouse or wherever we were spending the night and go through some of the traditional ceremonies. So for me, it was certainly an eye-opener. But even some of the youth that were on it, this was a whole new experience for them. And it built their pride and self-esteem, I think, in connecting with these traditions.
And I understand that Western Canoeing, the local canoeing company, actually makes a fiberglass version of the boat on the Vision Quest?
Exactly. Roy Henry Vickers went to Western Canoeing in Abbotsford and asked if they could design a sort of a modern version of the Haida dugout canoe. And they rose to the occasion and did that. They actually have four different versions now of dugout canoes, all fiberglass. The advantage of fiberglass, of course, is it's lighter because you have to carry these canoes up the beach, and it's easier to maintain. You know, you don't have to deal with a wooden hull. And it's consistent. You know what you're going to get. Whereas sometimes a dugout canoe, halfway through, you'd have to abandon it because you found a knot in the wrong place or rod in the middle or something, right? So anyway, now the villages usually have a combination of traditional dugouts and sort of a fiberglass modern version.
It's been really nice talking to you this morning, Sanford. And I don't want to leave people with the impression that the entire book is about dugout canoes, because I've actually just been asking you questions about that one chapter. There's a whole lot of stuff in the book.
Well, I cover all the different types of canoes in BC, and I include kayaks and dragon boats in the canoe family. So I cover all the types that you see on the waters here.
It's a great book. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Jane.
I've been speaking with Sanford Osler. His new book, Canoe Crossings, is available from Heritage House Publishing.